All right, Erev Tov, good evening, Chodesh Tov. It's Chodesh Nisan, which is always a wonderful time of the year. It's sort of spring is hopefully going to spring sometime. This evening I want to dedicate this shiur in memory of Nechama Leavitt. So Yotzeit is the 5th of Nisan. She died in 1997. And I'll talk a little bit about that at the end. You'll see on the last page there's a picture of her matseva, the tombstone that I went to visit her grave, paid homage to her in 1999, and I took a picture of the tombstone. I'll talk about that towards the end. This is a very difficult subject to talk about in many ways, but also very easy to talk about. When you speak to people who knew Nechama Leavitt, you'll find that everybody has a story to tell. Everybody's relationship to her was very unique. And there are people in this country, Rabbi Oretz, if you know him, who teaches the head at Bruria, Jay Goldmans, who's the head at Ramaz, various people around the country who I've bumped into who had the experience of being in her shiurim, Nachum Amzel that we've mentioned. He was very close to her towards her latter years. And many, many Israeli pedagogues and teachers, Yitzhak Reiner and Eliezer Sheffer, I don't know if these names mean anything to you, they're all people who are very well known in the firmament of the Misrad HaChinuch and various other places in Israel. I love the quote at the beginning, and I want to start with this because this is what I call typical Nechama. The Midrash states that teachers go straight to heaven because they have more than their fair share of hell on earth. But this is one of the few times I disagree with the sages because I think the teachers have more than their fair share of heaven on earth. And that's very typical Nechama. She was, to call her a natural was probably an understatement. It's remarkable that this woman became such an inspiration for literally thousands upon thousands of teachers, not just teachers, but people around the country, certainly in Israel and essentially around the world. And I want to share with you a little bit, firstly, of my personal connection with her, our personal, because my wife has there's a good story, a discussion we had with her many, many years ago. We'll also talk a little bit about her life history, a bit of a background, because that's also very intriguing, very inspiring. And we'll do a little bit of learning of Nechama, because when I gave this talk nearly 10 years ago, I prefaced it by saying that Nechama would have hated this evening. Any gathering talking about her, her life, her history, she would have said is a bittlesma. She would have got very upset. She would have said that if you're going to sit and study during the evening, fine. Beseder gamur. But if you're going to sit and talk about her, no. She would probably have not allowed it. And would have had what to say. So, you know, she's still sort of, even from the grave, as they say, she sort of commands a certain amount of respect, no question about that. And I want to sort of just take you through a little bit of her approach as well when we get to it, to give you some flavor of what Nechama Leavitt is about. If you've never opened the book, it's a book, it's a set of books, weekly studies in the Parsha. They came out in two different covers. One is a blue cover, the original one now I think has now come out in a white cover. I think they were updated a little bit. They originally came out in Hebrew. They now were translated into English. I think the last one was published in 1986 by the WZO, the World Zionist Organization. And if one's never opened that sefer, this is a discovery. One has to dip into it. It's not easy. We're not talking about sort of, you know, sitting and reading something off the internet. You know, if you have to give a talk on a Shabbat, this is not Nechama Leavitt. Nechama Leavitt is about looking at every nuance of Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, the whole spectrum of Torah literature, and trying to analyze, to understand, and to get to the deeper level of what it's really about. And I mentioned here, one of the things that is so unique about Nechama was the way that you had to address her. If you came into her class and you would call her Dr. Leavitt or Professor Leavitt, she'd be very upset with you. because she would think that she's done something to upset you. You had to call her Nechama. Now, this is even true. I remember Nachum Amzal mentioned to me, he said that if you called her on the phone and you would say, "Can I speak to Mrs. Leibowitz?" She probably would not take the call. You know, "I am Nechama Nimtzed." You would have to say, "Is Nechama there?" And then she'd answer the phone, "Ken, Nechama Medaberet." And you're talking to one of the great Bible scholars in the world on a first name basis. This was the way that she did it. She must have already been doing that particular approach right back in the early days. She started teaching in the 30s, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. As I say over here, it's kind of difficult for me as an Englishman to get used to calling anyone like that by her first name, but eventually even I managed to break the ice, as they say, with myself, and did talk to her on those terms, and it was just one of those experiences. Personal connection. Talk a little bit about some personal anecdotes. We first met Nechama, my wife and myself, when we went to spent Shavuot in Kibbutz Lavi. Kibbutz Lavi, for those who do not know, in the north of Israel, one of really the most beautiful parts of the north of Israel. It's just a magnificent place. My wife's grandmother was there in 1951, sort of one of the real chalutzot, and there's aunts and uncles and family there, cousins, etc. And in 1979, we'd just gone on Aliyah, about 2 months before that. And we went to Kibbutz Lavi to be with my wife's grandmother, and got into breakfast, Erev Shavuot, and who's sitting at the table? Safta and Nechama Leibowitz. And I did a double take, because I recognized her. You know, you see pictures of her. If you just see, this is the book that came out by Yael Unterman in English, and this is typical Nechama with the beret. Always, that was the way she looked, wherever. Never, ever sort of changed her uniform, probably in 50 years.
Never wore colour.
And very
black
little.
Black or grey.
Yeah, black or grey, and that was it. And that was Nechama. You knew, and she was sitting there. And we got introduced to her. So Savta Zichron Levrocha said that we'd come on Aliyah. And Nechama just was absolutely overwhelmed by anyone who came on Aliyah, particularly from England or from the United States, because of she sort of knew what you were leaving behind and coming to Israel. It was still pretty rough in those days. And it was a very interesting conversation. She started asking us, what are our plans? So we said, well, we're probably going to live in Yerushalayim, and I'm going to work there, maybe learn. I'm not quite sure what we said to her. And she said, no. She said, you've got to live in the kibbutz. Now, I didn't know Nechama Leibowitz at the time, because I did get to know her, and I realized that you can't argue with Nechama. It was just no point. You know, she had a kind of hashkafat chayim. She had a view of the world, and her view of the world was my way or the highway, as they say. And arguing her was a complete waste of time, but my wife decided to have a heated disagreement, because we had never considered living on a kibbutz. Kibbutz is one of those very specialized existences, which clearly is not for everybody. And for Nechama, this was a no-brainer, as they said. She said to us, you know, that everything gets done communally, and if you'll have more time to study. She saw it purely in terms of the ability to manage your time in the most productive way. And we agreed to disagree. Because we left the room that morning, and you know, she wanted us to come to the kibbutz, and we said, no, this is not going to happen. Saying that, I shall never forget the shiur. She gave a shiur on Leil Limud of Shavuot. She had literally the whole kibbutz in the Beit Knesset. The Beit Knesset is beautiful there. And must be, I don't know, 500 people sitting in the shul there. And she gave a shiur on the Witch of Endor, story at the end of Shmuel Aleph, and scared the bejeevers out of everybody, because she was a very, not only did she have the pedagogy of knowledge, but she was also trained in drama. So if she did teach you anything in terms of Tanakh, it was always with a very dramatic presentation. Okay, and she really was very, very good at it, and if she hadn't been a teacher, she probably would have been on the stage. I mean, she was that sort of character. I didn't see her again for a couple of years. This is 1979. In 1983, I went to learn in Kola. And I was doing a course for Rabbanut, and not quite sure whether I was going to stay in Israel, whether we were going to stay in Israel, or going to come to Chutz Laaretz, and eventually we decided to go back to London. But at that time, unbeknownst to me, the head of the Kola, this is in Mevaseret Zion, which is now a very successful American program, the head of the Kola, Rabbi Uri Cohen, who's the son-in-law of Kahati, those of you who know the Mishnayot, Kahati Mishnayot, he had arranged for that particular group that I was joining, that on Friday mornings, Nechama would come and teach at the Kola. Now, this is something which is unheard of, certainly unheard of in this part of the world. Imagine Lakewood, I mean, it would never happen in a million years. But the reality was that Rav Uri Cohen was very much a broad, he still is, he's not such a youngster anymore, but he's a very broad thinker. And he'd heard of Nechama, she gave Sichot, she'd spoke on the radio every Friday before Shabbat. And he wanted to bring her into the yeshiva. In 1974, I think it was, 76, she was teaching at Merkaz Arab. Tzvi Yehuda Cook was still alive, son of Rav Cook, and Rosh Yeshiva there, and he brought her into Merkaz. And again, there was a bit of a kerfuffle, you know, sort of the more right-wing world was very upset. How can you bring a woman in to teach in the holy walls of the yeshiva? Usually the people who complained about it were people who never knew Nechama Leibovitz. Because if they did know or had any experience of her learning, they wouldn't have said a word. Rav Riskin, in fact, had a very serious problem. He tried to bring her in 1987-88 into his program in Efrat and got a tremendous problem because one of his students went to ask someone in Bnei Brak, I think Rav Shach, or one of the Rosh Yeshivas in Ponovich, and got the answer, no, this is not acceptable. And Rav Riskin was there fighting City Hall, and it really didn't work. And I don't think she gave those shiurim. We were lucky. We were lucky because Rav Uri Cohen went to ask Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, one of the great, great tzaddikim of Yerushalayim. And Rav Orbach realized that this was a serious question, and he gave a fabulous answer. And his answer was, he said, listen, Rav Uri, he said, if you can get anyone better to teach, take the other person. Meaning, Rav Orbach was saying to Rav Uri Cohen, if you find someone better, meaning, if I say that you can take her, I'm in trouble with all the Haredi guys that I live with. On the other hand, if you don't take her, you're crazy, because she's offering a course of learning which your students will all benefit from. So what Rav Orbach said is that take her, but I'm not giving you an allowance. I'm not saying it's forbidden. I'm not saying it's allowed, but you'll be crazy if you don't. And Rav Uri got the message, and she started. And of course, the famous story, which many of you will have heard, is the question of the mechitza, right? The young men in the kollel at the time, not me, I have to say, but a number of the Israeli boys who'd all gone through Hesder, they said, well, you know, if Nechama Leibovitz is coming to teach, number one, the wives, they were young marrieds, the wives wanted to come and hear her. But if the wives are coming, you've got to have a mechitza. So Chama heard about this and said, this is ridiculous, because if the wives are sitting behind the mechitza, she's sitting behind the mechitza with the wives. You know, for goodness sake, guys, grow up. And what happened was that in the end, they made a compromise without a mechitza, I'm glad to say. And Chama taught the class, and the women sitting on one side, and the men were sitting on the other side. And it was dynamite. Every week was a chavaya. It was an experience. It was a hard class. It was not easy. Her demands on the students were very, very high. This goes right back. People have told me, I spoke about this to students who had her in Machon Gol. Those who used to go to Israel in the 70s, the boys would go to Keren Biavna. There's literally two places to go. For the boys, Keren Biavna, and for the girls, Machon Gol. There was really nothing else. You look at the situation today, it's quite amazing. And in Machon Gol, she was teaching for a number of years. And there's a lot of people remember her again being very tough. She always insisted that you came to the lesson with a book, with a sefer. If you turned up without a sefer, you were not asked to leave, you were told to leave. And if everybody turned up without a sefer, she left. This is a famous story that the girls were on an outing, and they all came back late, and they didn't get back to their room to get their Tanakh. So they all turned up to her lesson, and she looked and she said, "Enaf echadim sefer, nobody's got a sefer," and she walked out. Nechama walked out. She said, "I refuse to teach this class." The girls were dumbfounded. And then somebody explained that this was a lesson for future teachers, that if you're going to teach Tanakh, make sure everybody has a book. I tell my students at Stern College this story, and I said, look, I appreciate that, you know, it's all getting hold of the same, especially at the beginning of the semester, and now with computers, they have it all on different web pages and whatever. And, you know, things have become a sort of bit less tense about it. But Nechama was absolutely insistent, you have a sefer. 1983, I use the word survive. I survived 6 months in her class because it was tough. She absolutely expected you to be fluent in Tanakh. Now, very good for people growing up in Israel who studied Tanakh at that level for a long time. But for guys like me, coming from England where we didn't know anything, certainly not Tanakh, it was very, very tough. And it was a very, very steep learning curve. But it was an experience. Every week there was something to take away, to go and talk about, and it was wonderful. She did this course for 6 months. I eventually returned to London. And in 1994, this is 10 years later, I made a trip with a number of teachers. There was something called the Torah Department, which I don't know if it still exists, part of the WZO. And they took teachers to Israel to, you know, sort of study and be with academics. It was very interesting. And the highlight, everybody who went on those trips said the highlight of the trip was the evening with Nechama. Nechama had become, at that stage, she was kind of frail. She wasn't going out to teach anymore, but she taught in her apartment. Her apartment was probably half the size of this room, and it was divided into three rooms. You came in, on the right, there was a very small kitchen. On the left, I think, was her private room, her bedroom, whatever. And then there was the what they call in Hebrew, the salon, which sounds very grand, but this was 2x2, this whole room. And what she had done in her years, in her 90s, is that because these groups were coming in, more or less one after the other, from the States, from England, from all over the world, and also from Israel, she put benches, she put like rows of benches in the room, and you sat there in front of Nechama, and as they say in the classics, you were tittering. Everybody came in, had an experience of Nechama once upon a time, and although she's sitting there, she's 92, 93 years old, we're all shaking in our boots. You know, we're waiting for her to ask us the obvious question, and you don't know the answer, and she, you know, and she would do her thing. And I never forget the walking into that room, and I looked at her, and I said, Nechama, ma shalomech, how are you, Nechama? So she looked at me, she said, her eyes lit up. She said, Mashlomcha, I says, Eifata. So I said, where are you now? So I said, Aniba Anglia, which she wasn't so excited about, but whatever, she was very polite. And then she said, Mashloma Mishpacha. So I said, Nechama, Mishpacha, I haven't seen you for 10 years. She starts going through the relatives, all my wife's family, she knew, in the kibbutzim and in Yerushalayim and whatever. I'm saying, Nechama, well, unbelievable. She says, 92 years old, very frail, but her mind was so, so sharp, it was a revelation. And this is how she was. She was a phenomenal person to interact with. There was always a good, you know, sort of sense of coming away from an interaction with Nechama. You felt, you know, she lifted your spirits. It was remarkable. And even when she was sick, towards the end, she still managed to do this. I remember the shiur that I sat in. I sat in this room. And in the middle of her shiur, I asked her a question. And the shiur stopped. There must have been 30 people sitting in the room. And she stopped. And I thought, oy vey, you know, this is it, I'm in trouble. You know, you sort of try to disappear under the table. You know, the teacher's is going to do something. And she got up, which was not easy for her. She couldn't move very well. And she said, Tislachuni, she said, forgive me. And she disappeared onto the mirpeset. She had a small balcony outside. And she came back with one of these yellow pieces of paper. And I'll talk about these papers in a minute. And it was from 1951, the date at the top. And the question that I'd asked was on the paper. Unbelievable. She'd found this paper. She had thousands of these sheets, which I'll explain what they are. And she found the question. And then for the next 20 minutes, she spent the time going through the sheet, explaining and answering the question that I'd asked. It was a wow. Never forget it. Never, ever forget it. What are these sheets?
Gilyonot.
These sheets, it says at the top, Gilyonot. In 1942, and this is where it goes back to, she decided that she was going to single-handedly save the Israeli Postal Service from bankruptcy. What do I mean? She decided to make a system of putting out these Hebrew-typed pages, which she typed herself, and obviously then the Shachpel, she photocopied, not photocopied, she, whatever they used to do in those days, 1940s, I don't know, but they used to copy them up, and these were sent out all over the world. I got these copies from someone in London, who's no longer alive, who gave me a whole bunch of them, because she was doing them in the 50s, you actually had all of the commentaries written out. You had the questions at the bottom. Some questions were supposedly easy questions. Some questions, it says, a bit more difficult. And then some questions, what we would call impossible, but she put it on the page. Didn't say that, but that's what it was. And at the bottom, she would say, send your answers, and she would then send you back the answer that you gave, she would grade you, right? And she put what they call kishkushim. She sometimes puts different gradings and markings all over the papers. I've got a few of them at home. These are still pristine. They've not been worked on. And the story goes that in 1940s, when she started with 10, 15, 20 people. One of her favorite connections, it grew very quickly because everybody heard about it and they wanted to do it. She got once a paper which was covered in sand. And she saw that the people who were sending it, the address was El Alamein, Egypt. There are two soldiers who were in the Jewish brigade, I think they were there, from Israel, or maybe from Europe, I don't know where they were. And they got into this brigade and they were studying her work while waiting for Rommel to decide what he was going to do in El Alamein, which was the turning point of the war, certainly in that part of the world. That's why people in Israel were not affected in the end by the Germans. And she said that it was covered in sand, you know, because this is what they sent. They sent a very sandy piece of paper back to her. What I love about this, and I showed my wife this just before, is the address at the bottom. It says like this, Yesh lishloach et ha-tshuvot, please send the answers. Now you'll say the address. Now this is so Yerushalayim of the 1940s. The address is Nechama Leibovitz, Yerushalayim, Kiryat Moshe. Imagine, you know, it's Moshe Cohen, Jerusalem. He'll get to you. I mean, it's unbelievable. That was the address. This is how it was. And of course, as I said, for the Israel Postal Service, it was a blessing because she literally, by the time she this really got going, she was literally answering hundreds upon hundreds of these gilyonot. She was doing them every single week. It's amazing. She got to the point, I think, in 1970, 71, when she gave up the teaching in Tel Aviv University. And I think the gilyonot, that was it. She ended the project, but of course it went on to something else. And if you have the books at home of the weekly studies, the gilyonot, these original pages, became the weekly studies. And to this day, if you look online, you go home and Google Nechama Leibovitz, you will find a number of scholars in Israel who are still working on these gilyonot. These are 50 years old. Yeah. This one is from Tavshin Tet, 1949. So 70 years old. And there are scholars still working on them because what Nechama did not do is give you the answers. Didn't even give you a clue as to what the answer was to the question. She would give you the question, she would give you the sources, and then she'll say, you work it out, and let me know what you think. And there are still many people in Israel. There's somebody called Shmuel Peerless, I think comes from the States originally, who's trying to bring out books of these things, trying to answer the questions that Nechama left as questions, literally hundreds, if not thousands of questions. It's fascinating. And this stuff is still being worked on, even though we're talking about she's been gone for over 20 years. Quite amazing, amazing. After that particular interaction in 1994, I heard with great sadness that in 97 she passed away, Erev Pesach, the 5th of Nisan, and about 2 years later I was visiting Israel, went to be with the family, and I persuaded my wife's uncle to take me to the kever, take me to the grave of Nechama Leibovitz. And he thought I was a bit loopy, but I said, I feel I need to make that pilgrimage. So if you look on the back, you'll see on the last page, and I want to mention this because otherwise I'll forget to mention it, on her matseva, and I'm sorry the picture's not great, but you can see her name, Nechama Leibovitz. You can see at the bottom here, there's Hey Nisan, right, the date. And there's one word. Can you work out what the word is? Mora. It's all she wanted on her tombstone. Teacher. She said, that's all I'm allowing you to put on my tombstone. This is a Musa Haska. If there's no greater Musa in one's life experience than to see this tombstone and realize that for this woman and what it represented, this is not blowing her own trumpet, the heifer. This is saying that this was her privilege, this was her tachlis, this was her purpose, and this is what she wanted as a memorial. And it's so powerful. I joke with my uncle who took me there, my wife's uncle, that, you know, that she's probably going to sort of see me coming and sit up and say, get out of here, go and learn. Because she would not want, you know, pilgrimages and all this sort of stuff. She just wouldn't be interested in it. But this is something very special. You know, and there's pictures of it in the book. This book actually came out about 10 years ago by Yael Unterman. She emailed me. Interestingly enough, she's originally from London. And there's pictures of the tombstone here as well. Clearer pictures with a lot of other material. This is the book to read. If you're more inspired to find out a little bit about her and about her ideas, then there's about three or four books that came out in Hebrew, but this one in English by Yael Unterman is really excellent, outstanding. And that's the book that I would certainly recommend. In terms of life history, got a bit of it on here. She was born in Riga, Latvia, which was a bit of a surprise. I always thought she was born in Germany. She came over as looking or sounding very Germanic, but she really wasn't. One of the interesting things that happened is that she was homeschooled. Her and her brother Yishai Leibowitz, also very fact that you can give a whole evening about him as well. And in 1925, she went to Berlin. Her parents are very educated. Her grandfather, it's this whole story here, that he's buried on the Mount Olives, Harzeitim. He studied in London and then went on Aliyah, worked in Shaarei Tzedek, which again, the early Shaarei Tzedek, the sort of the very, very early days. What is interesting about Nechama is that in 1925, she went to study in Berlin. Now, in Berlin in those days, who was in Berlin in 1925? And it's really quite staggering. There is a list of names of people, some of whom I hope you will have heard of, starting off with Rav Soloveitchik, was there for a couple of years studying his philosophical, doing his PhD and whatever subject it was. I don't know what the title was. There was also a gentleman called Rav Hutner, who became Rosh Yeshiva in Brooklyn, who was also in Berlin at that particular time. There was various other, Harry Wolfson. There's a whole list of very, very interesting academics and people that were there. And to top it all, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichron Livracha, was in Berlin at that time. And there is a lot of speculation as to whether Nechama had coffee with the Rebbe, you know, in a coffee house in Berlin in 1925 or 26, whether that really happened. Nobody really knows. What is told is that the when Rav Soloveitchik was asked whether he met Nechama Leibowitz in Berlin, he said, well, I went into the library one day in the university, we're in the same University of Berlin, and I saw a scholar behind an enormous pile of books. And I'd heard about Nechama Leibowitz, and I knew that was Nechama. That was his recollection of Nechama. And when you asked Nechama whether she'd met Rav Soloveitchik, she said, well, in 1925, 26, I walked into the library one day, and I saw a scholar behind an enormous pile of books, and I knew that was Rav Soloveitchik. And, you know, they both recognized each other behind piles of Sforim. That was their very cute interaction between the two. Did they actually meet each other? Not clear, but it's speculation. A lot of conjecture goes into whether they actually met up in Berlin or not. We don't know. I don't think anyone is absolutely sure about that, but they certainly were aware of each other. She had a lot of respect for Rav Soloveitchik, also because of his connection with Mizrahi, etc. So, just want to say a little bit more about her life. As you see over here, in 1930, she moved to Israel, but before she moved, she got married. And she married quite late, I guess. She was born in 1903, she got married in 1930, so you can see she was already late 20s. And she married her uncle, who was 30 years older than her. And it's an amazing story. He was, his name was Lippmann. And he was, again, very unclear to me, the whole sort of background to that particular shidduch, as they say. But what did happen is that she started reading texts for him. He was going blind. And this is seemingly where she began to get her tremendous expertise in textual studies. She would learn with him, she would read with him. She once, in a shiur that I was privileged to attend, she was talking about Rashi. And her thing about Rashi was very intense. She had a whole approach to Rashi's commentary. And she sort of just dropped a little nugget along the way. She asked the group, mainly, as I said, yeshiva boys who had gone through the Hesder program, she said, how many commentaries exist on Rashi? So we all sort of looked at each other, and I don't know, I braved an attempt. I said, I don't know, I come across five or six. Then she looked and sort of, you know, didn't really respond to that particular number. She said, well, I've looked at over 200 commentaries on Rashi, and she hasn't seen them all. In other words, she's seen 200, there's still more to go. And we all sat there, our mouths dropped. Because number one, who knew there were 200 commentaries on Rashi? And more to the point, that she'd seen them all. And she wasn't saying it again as a matter of self-grandizement. You know, she was just pointing out that there's what to learn. Wow. And this was, again, her thing. And particularly with Rashi, there is a very famous approach that she always had. And her thing with Rashi was very simple. She would do it, but in the lesson. She would come in and she would say, "I'm going to learn today this particular sugya, pasuk, or whatever." And she would, she immediately said, "Ma kashe b'pasuk? What's the problem?" And you would say, "Rashi omer." So she would stop you in your tracks. Rashi says. She said, "No, wait a minute." She says, "Before you tell me what Rashi says, I'm going to ask you a question." And her famous question is, "Ma kashe l'Rashi?" What is Rashi's question that he makes his comment? Don't tell me what Rashi says. Tell me what Rashi's problem is that gets him to make that particular comment. And that's a wow, because nobody does that. Nechama started doing this, and it changes the whole way that you learn Rashi. Because what Rashi does, he doesn't necessarily give you the question, but he gives you the answer, and you've got to work out the question. And if you worked out the question, then the whole pasuk becomes much more challenging. The whole verse, everything that Rashi is trying to do, is based on the premise, ma kashe l'Rashi, what is Rashi's question? And this was Nechama 101. If you didn't have that particular understanding, ma kashe l'Rashi, you couldn't survive in her course, because, you know, this was what she expected everybody to be able to come out with. You have to think about it, because 9 times out of 10, Rashi doesn't tell you what the question is, but he assumes that you know what the question is, on which he is giving his comment. So this was very, very typical Nechama, and this is, again, one of the things that I learned from her. I also mentioned here the anecdotes. My wife goes crazy because she thinks there's too many anecdotes in when I speak, and I tell you the truth, you get carried away a little bit. But Nechama was, every time that she gave a lesson, there was always an anecdote. And it was usually about Israeli taxi drivers. And I think we've all got anecdotes to tell about Israeli taxi drivers. She loved the taxi drivers. And I might have mentioned this already in Nishiurim. I don't know. The wonderful story that she got into a cab the day after Yom Kippur. But I heard this story. I remember she said it in the class. And she said that the taxi driver was very tired. She looked and she saw this guy was really, really tired. You know, at that point, I would have got out of the taxi. I mean, with all due respect, you know, the drivers in Israel, you don't want to really take a chance. But she's sitting there, and she has this conversation with him, very surreal conversation. She says, "Adoni, why are you so tired?" So he said, "Lo yashanti kol alayla." He says, "I didn't sleep the whole night." Okay, he didn't sleep the whole night. It's Yom Kippur, you know, he probably had a bit of an upset tummy. No, he said, she sort of carried on the conversation as she would. And she said, "What happened?" So he said, "I was very upset yesterday at Mincha." And she just looked at him, she said, "Mincha, what happened?" He said, "I read the story of Yonah." So we all read the story of Yonah. And he said to her, "I have a real problem with a pasuk in the book of Yonah. It kept me awake the whole night." And at that point, Nechama says, "What is your question?" He then finds out in the conversation that she is, Nechama Leibowitz, he's heard of her. And he realizes that this is his lucky day. He's going to get an answer to his question. And they literally, for the taxi ride, for 20 minutes, were talking about this pasuk. And she gave him an interpretation of the pasuk, which she saw a whole weight lifted off his shoulders. She said that this man, when he heard that you can read the pasuk in a different way and interpret it in a different way, all of a sudden, all of the cares of this man's life at that moment sort of just dissipated. Everything went back to normal. And he thanked her profusely, did not charge her for a fare, because he realized that he got himself a bargain. You know, he got a real bonus out of this. A fabulous story. And she, again, would say at the end of this anecdote, when she's, and with a big smile on her face, she would say, "Mi ka'amcha Yisrael, which people in the world could you have that experience where you get into a taxi?" Don't try this in New York, for goodness sake. When you get into a taxi and you have a conversation about the book of Yonah, and you start talking about these very difficult and intense subjects in Bible, she said, "Only one people in the world, Mika Amcha Yisrael, only the Jewish people." And you heard it from the Chama, it was just overwhelming. And she used the anecdote, she used it very effectively, she used it very, very well. She also had a tremendous sense of the language. She would teach you, and one of the great things that I picked up from her is the sound of Hebrew. And I'll give you an example. She was teaching the Haftarah, which we read a few weeks ago, for the story of Shmuel, when he kills the king of Amalek, Agag. And the word that is used in Hebrew, Vayishasef. Shasef means he literally took a sword and he cut him down. And the Chama would stand there and say, in Hebrew, you have onomatopoeia. You can actually hear the word doing something. So we said, what do you mean? So she explained, Vayishasef, you can hear the word, the sword cutting through the air. The word Shasef, you hear this. It's like the wind is being cut by the sword, because Shmuel is taking the sword and he is killing the enemy king. And you sit there, your mouth drops, because you know what? There's a point to this. And she opens your eyes, the Chama, to stuff like this, which is above and beyond. The example that I want to give, because I'm going to run out of time very quickly, is something from the parsha that we read 2 weeks ago. We read the story of the golden calf, Egel HaZahav. And this is taken from one of Nechama's studies, and I call it a journey, because what Nechama would do is that she would take you on a journey through the world of commentary. And it's a very simple question that she asked. She always raised obvious, we would almost call them simple questions, but they weren't simple at all. Moses comes down the mountain and he sees the Jews dancing and doing all their thing of the idolatry. He's just got the Torah, he's holding the tablets of stone. And we know what happened. Boom, he threw them down and they smashed. And the Chama asks the obvious question, which is, what's going on here? Why did Moshe do this? Where was the command from God to do it? God has just given him the tablets of stone, and he's come down the mountain, and he sees the Jews dancing and whatever they're doing, and the tablets he throws on them. Who told Moshe to do that? Why did he do it? What was the purpose? And all of a sudden, you start saying to yourself, wow, this is a story that I've taken for granted for so many years, but I've never asked the question. I've never asked myself the question, why did Moshe do this? It's like, you know, the most obvious thing. She takes you on a journey. She says, let's look at the Pashtanim. Pashtanim are the people who interpret the text in the most literal fashion. Famous Rashbam, grandson of Rashi. And the grandson of Rashi says, you know what happened? He saw the people dancing around. He became shvach. He became weak and he dropped the tablets. You know, sometimes you just lose that kind of strength or whatever. Boom, and they fell down. Says Nechama, thank you very much, from Shmuel ben Meir, but it doesn't fit into the Pasuk. She would say this. She would say, with all due respect, it doesn't fit into the Pasuk. And she says, the reason is because it says, Moshe got angry. We know that he got very angry and he threw them down. So to say that he became Shvach and the thing dropped on the ground, doesn't work. It's a very nice pshat, but it's not what the Pasuk says. So she says, all right, if we're not going to get the answer from there, let's go back to Midrash. Let's see if Midrash can help us out, because she wants to get a bit more off the literal interpretation and get into a more detailed interpretation. So she brings Midrash, which is section B. And I'm just going to, again, go through this. You can take this away. You can look at this in your own time, because you'll see how this all fits together so beautifully. The Midrash basically is as the summary at before the broken line where it goes, where it's section C. Three lines up. According to the above three Midrashim, Moses' motive in breaking the tablets was in defense of Israel, to provide an extenuation for their sin, to throw his lot in with theirs. In other words, if he's holding the tablets and they're doing idolatry and the tablet says don't do idolatry, then what does Moshe say? If I'm holding the evidence against the Jewish people on these tablets, I've got to throw them down, I've got to break them. So that when God comes and judges the Jewish people, there's no document, right, to prove their guilt. He says it's a bit like the person who's the Midrash gives an example of a woman who commits adultery, and the husband has Rachmanis on her, so he tears up the ksuba. He tears up the marriage documents just to kind of alleviate the situation, that maybe you can mitigate the guilt. So throwing down the tablets, mitigating the guilt. Says Nechama, thank you very much, but it doesn't work in the Pasuk. Again, it's very nice, it's very homiletic, very beautiful, but it doesn't work because it's not what the Torah actually says that happened. So she says, okay, let's go to Rashi, as I said in section C, Maka Shela Rashi. Rashi's got the same question. What is going on with Moshe that he threw down the tablets? And it says particularly in anger. And we know this was an issue later on, that with the hitting the rock and he got angry, there was something going on here. So again, according to Rashi, Rashi essentially takes on the reading from the Gemara, and according to Rashi, this is Moshe punishing the Jewish people. It's an act of punishment. It's an act of saying that you don't deserve these tablets that I brought specially from God, from Mount Sinai. Boom, he threw them down, which is again very interesting way of looking at the whole story, but doesn't work with the pasuk. It just doesn't fit in with this idea that Moshe was punishing Am Yisrael. There's no intimation, there's no guidance in the Psukim that that's what really happened. She brings also Rabbi Yitzchak Ramah from the Spanish 1300s, also says similar to Rashi. If you go onto the third page, she takes you to the 19th century. She's walking you through history. She says, let's see what the Netziv, the famous Rosh Yeshiva Volozhin, 19th century, one of the most wonderful commentaries on the whole Torah. And she says, for the Netziv, there is a psychological issue here. And let's look at this paragraph, it's section E. And I'm just going through this, I'm sorry, I'm rushing through this, but I'll just give you some idea of what she does. Walking you through history, right? She took you from Midrash, she took you to the 11th century, 13th century, she's now taking you to the 19th century. And you're on a trip, you're on literally, you know, the magical mystery tour with Nechama Leavitt. And here she goes, she says, what does the Netziv say? He says, the text describes the greatness of Moses, took the calf and burnt it, and no one resisted him, whereas they had forced Aaron to make it. Right, so Moses was much stronger than Aaron. This is because Moses, with deep psychological insight, had not broken the tablets on the mount, but resolved to bide his time in order to do it and make the greatest impact. So again, according to Netziv, he sees Moshe breaking the tablets at that moment to make the impact on the Jewish people. Says Nechama, it's a fabulous interpretation, but it doesn't fit in with the concept of what happened. Because if Moshe is waiting and wants to get the right moment, it implies a certain amount of, how should we say, preparation. And if you read the story, it seems to be, he sees the Jews dancing, he loses his temper, boom, and he throws them down. There's no concept of Moshe preparing for this particular event. So with all of the wonderful interpretation that Netziv brings, she still says it doesn't really work. Look at the comment. But was Moses' action as deliberately geared to an educational aim as these commentators have made out? Did he really, as Netziv suggests, bide his time till the psychological moment arrived? Is there a concept Moshe was standing back waiting to throw the tablets? Doesn't say any of that. It says he saw it, boom, and he reacted. So she says, I just can't deal with Netziv in terms of what the pasuk is doing. She goes to the 20th century. She's kind of desperate at this point. But she gets to Rameh Simchov Devins, one of the great commentaries, Meshech Chochma, one of the fabulous commentaries. He died in 1926. And she says that he's probably got the closest thing that she feels is an interpretation. And for her, it works. She said what Moshe was afraid of when he saw the Jews dancing there was that they were looking for a substitute in terms of leader. They were, instead of Moses, hadn't come back, so they've had a golden calf. And he says the danger was that if they got the tablets, they would turn the tablets into a golden calf. Golden calf would be destroyed, but they had this kind of Yetzer Hara, this thing was already cooking in them, that they would become enamored with the concept of a physical representation of God amongst them. And the next thing you know, that the tablets, instead of being the word of God coming down from Mount Sinai, would become a representation, God forbid, of God himself. And therefore, he says that in order to make the point, Moshe, with the anger that he felt at the time, also wanted the Jewish people to understand having a physical representation of God was not acceptable. So she says, basically, what Rameh Simcha does is, within the anger of Moshe, within his reaction, he explains to us what is the raison d'etre, what really was Moshe's motivation. And she likes that very much. And she says, the reason why I like it so much is because the Talmud says, and she goes right back to Talmud, and it's a famous comment Rashi brings this, where the word in the Torah says, Asher Shibarta. God comments to Moshe that you broke the tablet, says the Gemara, Asher Lashon Yasher Koach, like you say when somebody gets called up. Yasher Koach. God is saying to Moshe, well done that you broke the tablet. Now, according to everything that we've said so far, it's not so clear if it's so well done, right? If it's he got weak, or he did it out of anger, or he did it sort of out of punishment for the Jewish people. This is very difficult to say that God would praise him for this. But if you understand here that he's teaching the Jewish people a lesson, that you can't substitute God for something human, the whole concept of God is incorporeal, ein lo guf, ein lo demut haguf, as we say, then it becomes a lesson for life. And that, Hashem says to Moshe, yasher koach, well done. Well done that you taught the Jewish people that this is the way to go. And what I've done, and I've been makatze, I'm sorry, I've done this very quickly, but what I wanted to show you is that whenever you study something like this, which seems such a simple point that we've always, you know, we learned it in Hebrew school. He came down the mountain, he saw, boom, he threw down his tablets and Gemara. That's the whole story, but it's not so straightforward. The reality of it is that what Nechama has tried to do is take us on a journey through the different commentaries, through different stages. There's a wonderful anecdote that somebody said that when Nechama passed away and she got to Shemayim, she said there was a whole bunch of rabbis waiting for her. And who were these rabbis? They were all rabbis that nobody had ever heard of till Nechama came along. She re-found so many rabbis who nobody had really studied properly. From the Middle Ages particularly, she found manuscripts. She was in the Hebrew U, Hebrew University Library, and she found stuff there, and she incorporates it into her work. And they're literally lining up to say, you know, Shalom Aleichem, welcome, because you made us well known again. We're in obscurity for hundreds of years, and you brought us back to the Jewish world. I want to just finish with one or two final comments, as you'll see on the back here. Her contribution to the Jewish world, thousands of students who embody her style of learning. You were inspired by her. I don't know if I can say, I just feel so much of what I do in my teaching, it's from the Chacham Leibowitz. There's no other way to describe it. There are a few influences, but she was one of the main ones. Women's Minyanim. Would she have been interested? Absolutely not. Oh my goodness, I don't know what she would have said. She was around sort of at the beginning when it started in the 80s, a little bit. She would have seen it as a non-Jewish influence coming from the outside, from the women's liberation movement. And she did make one or two comments about it. I don't know. Certainly would not have been in favor of that. Women learning. I think the Yoetzet program, the women who are now answering questions, she may have been more comfortable with, but certainly not the idea of a woman's minion and all these sort of things that have come about. This is not Nechama. Nechama was about learning. She wanted, for her, it was literally the whole cure for everything. Go and study, spend time learning Torah, and that's what you've been put on this world to do. And this was her whole approach. A beautiful story, the Yemenite and the Bavitcher Rebbe. I'll tell you this little story because it's so poignant. We talk about two great people in the 20th century, both of whom did not have children, the Bavitcher Rebbe and the Chacham Leibowitz. Neither of them had children. Thousands of students, thousands of Hasidim, but no children. And the story is a beautiful story. There was a Yemenite couple that had been married for 10 years. They had no children. They went to Nechama Leibowitz. They heard she was a great woman. And they went to see her, and they wanted to get a bracha from her. And she was certainly not remotely going to be involved with that. This wasn't her style. But she sat there, apparently, and she was prepared to talk to them. And they told her the dilemma, should they stay together or should they divorce? So she said to the husband, do you love your wife? He said, yes. She said to the wife, do you love your husband? Yes. So she said, that's a recipe for staying together. You should be blessed, etc. Gave them whatever bracha she could give them. And they went away happy. 6 months later, they go to New York and they go to visit the Bavitcher Rebbe. And they have the same dilemma, the same question. Should they get divorced or not? So the Rebbe sat there and he heard the story. So he says to the husband, do you love your wife? So he said, yes. Said to the wife, do you love your husband? She said, yes. She said, you should have a bracha, stay together, etc., etc. And apparently the two, the stories got connected because obviously the Yemenite couple came back to Israel and said, you know, they told Nechama, they said, you know, exactly what you said, exactly what the Bavitcher Rebbe told us. And I find that story so beautiful and so poignant because as much as it's about this couple, it's also about the Rebbe and it's about Nechama. It wasn't about the having the children in the physical sense, because they had students, thousands, literally, both of them. The story of the Levaya was a very moving story, that when the Chaim Leibowitz was buried, the only person to say Kaddish was her nephew. Shai Leibowitz had a son who stood up and said Kaddish, but he made an announcement before the Kaddish. And he said, he announced that anyone who wants to say Kaddish from the Chaim Leibowitz, please join me. And he thought there'd be one or two people. Hundreds of people said Kaddish at that moment, because it was like losing a parent. It wasn't just like losing a teacher, it was like losing a parent. And they literally, I think even taught Korea, some of them, and they certainly, they all joined in. The Kaddish apparently was just overwhelming. If you're in Har Menuchot, that's where she is buried, there's certainly, as I said, I did the pilgrimage. And then again, I'm not sure if she will approve, but I felt that this is something that I really had to do. One of the things that I really learned from her, which to this day is part of my teaching, is to accept the truth from wherever it comes. She was criticized for this, but she stuck to her guns. She would refer to reform, conservative, what we call today, any type of scholar who would be suggesting some sort of idea. She'd never rejected it. She said that's what the Abarbanel did, that's what other great rabbis did. They listened to the people in their generation. She quotes somebody called Benno Jacob. Benno Jacob was a famous reform rabbi. He was part of the Abraham Geiger group and the whole history of the reform. She quotes him. And in fact, she put him into some sort of fame, because until she started quoting Benno Jacob, nobody ever heard of it, right? And nobody was studying his stuff. And she says he has a lot of very inspiring ideas. She quotes him almost in every parasha. It's quite amazing. Kasuta, various other gentlemen, apart from obviously the mainstream rabbis that she quotes over and over again. She was a wonderful pedagogue. Every lesson was an experience. I just want to leave you with this thought at the bottom here. Adina Bar Shalom. Adina Bar Shalom is the daughter of Rabbi Avadia Yosef. And every Friday afternoon, Nechama, for many years, gave a sicha on the parsha, 3:30 in the afternoon before Shabbat. Reshet Aleph, if you can get, maybe you can get it on the web, some of the recordings. And the Yosef family used to sit around and listen to this. Rabbi Avadia enjoyed it. So, listen to this, I'll read this in Hebrew. Adina Bar Yosef, Bito Bechora Shel Rav Avadia Yosef. She was the first born daughter of Rav Avadia. Zocheret, she remembers, Shekasher Yu Yoshvim, Saviv HaShulchan, when they used to sit around the table, Haya Avia Madlik Et HaRadio. Her father used to put on the radio, Erev Shabbat. Makshiv LeNechama Leibowitz, B'Tesumat Lev. He would concentrate, you know, very carefully on what she said. This is Rabbi Avadia, who was a walking encyclopedia. I can't tell you what this man knew. Ubekavod, and he would sit there in with respect. Umoreli ladav, and he would say to his children, "Limdu mimena, learn from her." Wow, that is. And if you know his attitude to women learning, which we did find out about on one occasion, it's even more amazing. He was not a great proponent of encouraging women to study, but when the Chama Leibowitz, he made a very massive exception. Yecheskel Abramsky, famous Dayan from London, made Aliyah in 1951, and he lived in Yerushalayim. And Nechama apparently asked him that she asked him to record some of his shiurim on Parsha, because it was something that she was interested in. And the word got back to him, and he agreed, and he was very, very happy to do so. And when he was asked by some of his more right-wing students, you know, what is this a proper connection? He commented in Yiddish, and I'll say the Yiddish and I'll explain. He says, "Die Yidna hat vos zu sagen." He says, "The lady has something to say." And that's coming from one of the greatest Talmudic scholars of the 20th century. "The Yidna hat vos zu sagen." That is the understatement probably of the century. She had a lot to say. She still has a lot to say. I hope that gives you some flavor, some idea of who she was, our personal interaction, a bit of her history, certainly a bit of her learning, the journey that we went on studying that particular area of something that we've all studied before. And just to get an awareness, if we come away from this evening, I come away from giving this type of talk always with the sense I must go back and look at the books all over again. If you can do the same, if you want to read something more on the history of Nechama, or go and study. I mean, this to me would be In her words, the greatest bracha, that if you've come out of this evening and you want to go back and study a bit more of what she has given us and what she has presented us in terms of her Torah studies, then kol hakavod. That really would be the sechar, zeh sechar b'amali. This would certainly be the sechar of what I've done, and I believe that she would approve. The yidna hodvos tzuzog, and something to take away. She had something to say. Any comments, any questions, please?
So the commentary on the parsha, that series, that's from the Gileonot?
Yeah, it started with the Gileonot, 1942.
Mm-hmm. So it was compiled.
Yeah, it was done in Hebrew, and thank God somebody translated into English.
Yeah.
Arya Newman, who I don't know him, but there were two people in the Torah department, Tomashov, whose son I knew. I was in Kola with him, and Newman, I don't know, but they did a very good job. And it's fabulous. It's not a, you know, this is not a book that you study to get a vort for 5 minutes, you know, to sit at the table.
No.
Serious Torah study. And she was a wow. She was kind of intimidating, I got to say, but in a good way. You never forgot her. Never forgot her. Any other comments? Okay, I hope that's given you food for thought. We are finishing up this week. I think we're certainly finishing up before Pesach. We'll have to discuss continuation, please God. As and when we're going to be doing it, so we will send out information. And I wish everybody Chag Kasher v'Sameach. Thank you for being sort of good listeners. You've really been good.
So
and Bezrat Hashem to be continued. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.